This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Pro athletes, surgeons, first responders, they all perform amazing feats while under a high amount of stress. So why do they thrive under pressure while others don't? George Everly Jr. and his two co-authors, Douglas Strauss and Dennis McCormick, study the actions of Navy SEALs and others who succeed despite the odds. In their new book, Stronger, Develop the Resilience You Need to Succeed, they identify factors that separate the best from the rest. And George, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
I'm happy to be here, Mark. Thank you.
Tell us about yourself and your co-authors. The three of you are a pretty interesting mix of different perspectives.
It is an unusual mix, isn't it? Well, I spend most of my career studying stress and stress-related illnesses. Wrote some of the first textbooks on treating stress-related illnesses and psychological trauma. So as you can imagine, my orientation was a very clinical one. After a few years of research, however, we realized that not only had we done research on what makes people sick, but we also had, almost inadvertently, collected data on what made people strong and resistant and resilient. So about 15 years ago, I decided to change my orientation. Rather than treating people who were sick, I wanted to help people who were healthy get even healthier or stronger. And I'd certainly seen people who had great potential, and I think everybody listening knew people who had great potential in life but never lived up to that potential. And you kind of wondered, well, what happened? Maybe they had all the right training, they had all the right genetics, but they didn't quite make it. And what we discovered was that a lot of times what happened is they simply couldn't stand the pressure. So I started looking at what helps people bounce back from adversity. Dr. Douglas Strauss is an organizational psychologist, and he actually studied organizations that bounce back from adversity. And Dr. Dennis McCormick is not only a psychologist, but he was one of the very first Navy SEALs. And his repertoire of skills and experiences is kind of mind-blowing. So we got together, and we thought, well, let's move beyond some of the research data. Let's talk to really resilient people. So Dennis suggested that we do some research with Navy SEALs and the probably the most elite group of warriors in the world. And it's kind of surprising that you don't find a lot of Olympic athletes or that level of athletic prowess there, but you find something very unique in SEALs. And what they are, above all things, I think, is resilient.
Now, you identify resilience as this key trait that separates those who succeed despite their circumstances from those who don't. Is resilience something you're born with, or is this something you can develop?
Well, that's a great question, and that was one of the daunting questions that we had to ask ourselves early on. If it's genetic, I'm not that interested in it because I'm interested in helping people develop more wellness-oriented and health-promoting attitudes and behaviors. So I think it's very clear to say that some people are indeed born with it. And some people on the other end of the spectrum, sadly, are born without it. Most of us are in the middle, though. I'd have to guess 80% of us are in the middle. So we have some degree of resilience, but we can get more resilient. So that is really the audience we focused on.
So what are the factors that make someone resilient?
I think first and foremost, you have to look at an attitude. Reality is a function of perception, isn't it? Two people see exactly the same thing. One sees something good, one sees something not so good. One sees the glass is half full, one sees it half empty. So one of the things that people had pointed to for years was optimism. So we passed out an optimism survey. Guess what happened? Everybody said they were optimists.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, that's not the right question. So then we said, okay, define optimism. Ah, that's where the secret was revealed. One group, most people, said, I believe things will turn out well. I hope things will turn out well. You know what the Navy SEAL said?
What's
I make say? Things turn out well.
Ah, big difference there.
It really is, isn't it? So what we realized, and we called it active optimism rather than passive optimism. And when you stop and think about the differences, they're really quite profound. Passive optimism optimists wait for things to happen. Their control of their lives is outside of themselves. The active optimists, they make things happen. They take control. Now, let's not be naive. You can't control everything in your life. I get it. But there are a lot of things where simple tenacity snatches victory from the jaws of defeat. And those are the people we read about. The ones that wait for that moment, that perfect moment of opportunity, often see it go away, never to return.
So active optimism is one of the key things. What are some of the other factors? You started to touch on them. It sounds like decisiveness and tenacity are important characteristics to have as well.
Yeah, they come kind of as a package. So it's one thing to be optimistic, have those thoughts, that attitude. But you have to act on it. You got to move forward. So people, did you ever notice that under stress, some people just procrastinate? They become immobile sometimes.
Right, or they're frozen by fear, yeah.
So what we found was highly resilient people had the ability to overcome procrastination and that frightening, freezing fear. So you have to move forward. But once you move, there's another aspect to it. You have to be tenacious. Because by definition, resilience is bouncing back from failure, setbacks, and adversity. So the resilient person expects to get knocked down, but they also expect to get back up. And relentless tenacity seems to be one of the single best predictors of success in almost any field, but it takes energy. And think about some of the messages we're sending the millennial generation. We say things like, it's not your fault. Don't worry about it. But what we have inadvertently done is take away their greatest potential strength. Until you can accept responsibility for your failure, you have no chance of taking responsibility for your success. So we've tried over the years, and I think we've failed, on this elusive thing called self-esteem. And it works with, I'm talking about children, I'm talking about young adults, young people coming into organizations. We are a bit overly protected. We try to hand them self-esteem. You can't give it away. You must earn it. And tenacity is the single best way to earn that self-esteem and ultimately that success, because other people will give up.
Now, you talked about getting knocked down. So I take it that failure is something that we should embrace. What is the role of failure in becoming a resilient person?
If you remember Al Newhart, he founded the USA publishing empire. And he said, when people said, what's your secret to success? He said, I failed. And I learned from my failure. And if you don't fail before you're 40, hurry up and fail, because it'll teach you more about life than success, absent failure. So I think it goes back to this notion of responsibility. If you fail and you ascribe it to forces far outside of your control, then you're like a cork just floating on a tumultuous sea. You're out of control. If, however, you say, well, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but I still can't control my reaction to things, that's what's important. We can't always control what happens to us, but we have remarkable control over how we react to it. I think about one of the stories. We have numerous stories throughout the book, and we've interviewed some fascinating people. Some are celebrities, professional athletes such as Cal Ripken, presidential candidates, who are currently running. We looked at Navy SEALs, elite warriors, and we found that they all shared some of the same characteristics. And bouncing back, anticipating failure, but getting back up, being tenacious, I mean, those were really the keys. And it goes back to the concept of what can I control and what can't I control. Control what you can, cope with what you can't.
One of the stories you tell is about your father. What are the lessons we can learn from the example he set?
Well, yeah. So I thought, well, should I include my father? But I'm biased. But I think he was an amazing man. If you read that section, you saw he was an interesting guy. Gifted musician, started playing professionally when he was 11 years old on a radio show. Now, remember, he came from Brokaw's Greatest Generation. And he grew up at a time when literally they had a horse and buggy and they had a lantern light to study by. But the radio was coming in, and it was the beginning of the big band era. My father was a gifted musician, as I said, began playing professionally on the radio when he was 11. Finished his career when he was 85, just to give you an idea. But he went away to war, and I asked him, I said, of course, I was the generation, Daddy, what did you do in the war? That was the question that all the kids in the neighborhood would pose. And my dad was part of the Battle of the Bulge, if you remember your history lessons. Mm-hmm. And that was when the German forces almost took back part of Europe. And it would have been a very different outcome to the war had they won. I asked my dad, it was a brutal winter, by the way, with one of the worst in Europe's history. And I said, Dad, what do you remember from the war? He said, well, it was tough. The winter was cold. And I said, Dad, what bothered you the most about the war? He said, in the Battle of the Bulge, the Germans dressed up in American uniforms. I didn't think that was fair. Are you kidding me? That's it? Now, what he also mentioned as a sidebar, by a V-2 rocket, and it exploded, it was on fire, and I had to hurry up and get out of the house. Really? That was a second thought? So years later, I read in the newspaper that the French government was giving American veterans the D-Day medal had they participated in the D-Day landing in Normandy. And I said, Dad, did you hear about this? And he said, yeah, that's interesting. So a few years later, we were watching Private Ryan. And stopped the video, and if anybody's ever seen that, it's a rather graphic mm-hmm. beach landing scene.
Oh, it's heart-wrenching, yeah.
And I said, yeah, and I said, Dad, what did you think? I stopped it when Tom Hanks reached the beach. And I said, Dad, what do you think so far? And he said, yeah, that's the way it was. I said, what do you mean? He said, that's the way it was. I said, how would you know? He said, well, I landed on Omaha Beach. And I said, Dad, you waited 50 years to tell me that you were part of the D-Day landing? That just seems atypical of today, shall we say. And I tried to analyze it. So I went to nursing homes, and I interviewed some of my father's generational cohort, and they just seemed to have a different attitude. They saw duty as something you just did because you were expected to do it, and you didn't expect to get a trophy for showing up, and you didn't even expect to get a trophy or a medal for doing a good job because that was what it was expected.
So with your dad, was it a matter of honesty and integrity that helped them be resilient?
I think they had a different view, yes, and I think that's certainly part of it. They flew by a different moral compass. I don't think there's any question about that. But you know what? I heard something similar from Cal Ripken, if anybody follows baseball, the Iron Man, mm-hmm. Cal Ripken. And he had a very similar ethic. And it was, I said, what's your key to your success? And he says, I just show up for work. I show up for work every day. And I try to earn my salary. I do what's expected of me. He actually said, kind of as a sidebar, that he said, I think my career was actually shortened because I didn't take time off. But I just felt an obligation to show up and put in a hard day's work. And that's what I learned, he said, from my father. So even though, well, and I guess Ripken Sr. was my father's generation as well. But they, they left an interesting legacy for some who were willing to listen, I guess.
George, what would you say to someone who tells you, I could never do this, I could never develop resilience, I've just got too many personal flaws to ever accomplish something like this?
I think it's a matter of learning. And I would ask them, do you have a brain? To borrow a line from Ben Carson, you know, do you have a brain? If you have a brain, you can think your way out of it. You can motivate yourself. It is never too late to become what you would have been, someone once said. And it's just a matter of getting a jump start. And I'd like you, talking about my father, as I mentioned, he was a musician for about 80 years. And he said something interesting. He said, old musicians never die. Their song has ended, but their melody lingers on. I would say to those people who say, I can't do this, I'd say, generations before you have done this. Look at them. What do they have that you don't have? And it's nothing that you can't acquire. The people that say, I can't do this, have given up before they've ever started. And that's sad.
George, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Happy to do it, Mark.
George Everly Jr., co-author of the book Stronger, Develop the Resilience You Need to Succeed.